The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're back in action as far as college classes are concerned at Ed Stone and, of course, over in Edmond, our headquarters campus. So that means we're very near to the end of this school year, which is hard to believe. We'll be entering into the month of May here in a couple of days, and then I believe the last day of classes is just a week and a half away. And then the final exams, and then all of those exciting activities at the end of the year with the final ladies' night for the Spokesman's Club, and then grad ball and grad brunch, and of course graduation. So a busy time, and that'll lead into I know it'll be a busy summer for many of you as well. But it's nice that we can get together in the friendly confines of this radio studio every day, people listening in to the live stream and also at downloading the podcast, which you can receive at the trumpet.com website and also kpcg.fm. Last week, Sam patched together some content for the Friday program as we were away down in the London area. But before that, I think the Thursday show, we went bit by bit through some of the details from the Mueller report, and we've got an interesting article, I think, from, who was it, Kim Strassel, I think it was. We'll go through a fair bit of that in just a moment as well. Last week, I also talked about the upcoming visit, President Trump's visit to Great Britain, an official state visit this time around, and as you would expect, there's people that are excited about it and people that are very much against it. Jeremy Corbyn came out and said that he's not going to attend the official state dinner. He received an invitation from the Queen and has decided not to attend the gathering that would include the Queen of England and, of course, President Donald Trump. This was the statement coming from Corbyn's office. It says, Theresa May should not be rolling out the red carpet for the state visit or for a state visit to honor a president who rips up vital international treaties, backs climate change denial, and uses racist and misogynist rhetoric. The Times of London says that so far Mr. Corbyn has made it to just one state dinner thrown in honor of President Xi of China a month after his election as a Labour leader. So he's happy to attend a dinner in honor of the President of China, but not so for the President of the free world. This clip will play for you. It's from Harry Cole. He's a commentator here in the UK. He was on Question Time last Thursday, following Jeremy Corbyn's announcement that he wouldn't attend this state dinner in honor of President Trump. And here's what this UK commentator had to say, clip one.
We finally now know who Jeremy Corbyn won't have dinner with. he literally had a takeaway with Hamas. These are, for those who don't know, Hamas's charter says that they will drive the Jews of Israel into the sea. Jeremy Corbyn had a takeaway with them. He invited the IRA to tea at the House of Commons 2 weeks after they'd tried to assassinate the Prime Minister and blow up the cabinet. He calls Hezbollah his friends. He spins for Iranian state television for the sum of £20,000. He is invited to dinner every passing communist and dodgy cleric for the last 30 years, yet he draws the line at the leader of the free world. He was happy to go to the palace and have dinner with the president of China, who is literally putting Muslims in concentration camps in China, but he won't fulfill his role as the leader of the opposition and greet our closest ally and our queen.
That's from a commentator here in the UK pointing out what should be just ridiculous. The radical left, you see it in both countries. People in the UK, people in the United States who hate government institutions, hate the history of the United States, or hate their own history. And they're quite happy to prop up every tyrant or dictator around the world. But then they won't even meet with a close ally. Well, Corbyn's not alone. There were a lot of people with that last trip. What was that, last year or the year before, when President Trump made that brief visit to the UK, and it had to be scaled down to a tour rather than a state visit because there were so many leaders in Britain that were against it. Prince Charles and Prince William, they wouldn't even meet with Donald Trump. And then you know about the big balloon, the Trump baby blimp that flew over London when they had all those protests, the demonstrations that, they showed up in, I don't know, tens of thousands or certainly thousands, marching in London, Edinburgh, taking to the streets to protest the President of the United States. That's coming up, as I say, in June. There's going to be some festivities down in Portsmouth and, of course, some things in and around the London area. I don't think it's yet locked in what he'll do in London, because he's going against Mayor Khan as well. He's very much against the president's visit. So there's some supporting it and some who very much hate this president of the United States, as if there aren't worse problems to focus on. It's just like the president pointed out with respect to the Democrats in Congress. Look, it's time to get to work. The Mueller report is out. There's no collusion. There's no crime. There's no underlying crime. And so get on with your jobs. Start passing legislation that will help our nations. The USA Today, this was interesting because it was the USA Today writing about the crime here in the UK. And of course, the United States has its own problem with respect to violence, usually gun-related violence. Here in the UK, it's knife crime, knife-related homicides. It gives some figures here in the USA Today. Over the course of 1 year, March of 2017 to March of 2018, 285 people murdered in England and Wales. 285, and most of that comes from knife crime. They don't have as many guns here, but they're still managing to kill each other. It says, unlike the USA, where guns are tied to many deaths, only 4% of homicides here last year were from shootings. That's speaking of the UK. 39% were from sharp instruments, or knives, in other words. But the thing that this article draws attention to is how that this cancer is spreading largely because of Britain's youth, our young people. That's why it's so pervasive. Because young hoodlums are roaming the streets with sharp objects, with sharp knives. So far this year, there have been 40 people fatally stabbed to death in Britain. That's just in the first few months of 2019. 40 people knifed to death. And as I say, the United States is far from immune from this cancer, this disease. Just look at the stories from over the weekend. The shooting near the Baltimore church. I think there was one man who died, several of them that were shot. This gunman just firing into a crowd indiscriminately. That was yesterday. And then you had the shooting at that synagogue outside of San Diego on, I think that was on Saturday. One dead and several injured. This is from NBC San Diego. It says a man with an assault rifle entered Poway, I guess it is. This is a suburb of San Diego, this synagogue there, and opened fire on the people inside, law enforcement officials said. And there were some other stories about how that, I guess, the gun jammed or something. It could have been a lot worse than it was. So these are becoming routine. And then, of course, you have the media just eager to get in front of the camera as soon as these things happen and to blame Donald Trump. He's the problem. Grabian put together this montage. This is just from the weekend. all of these people, all of these commentators at NBC and CNN blaming the president for these shootings. Clip two.
This is an epidemic, and we have a president who will not, who not only will not acknowledge that we have an epidemic of white nationalist terror after New Zealand said just a few people, he's providing the mood music for it. That is the reality we face.
Yeah, I think the president needs to at some point look in the mirror and understand that the rhetoric, the words he uses in all of this inflame this a big part of what's going on in America, give permission to the most craziest people in America.
And it happens in part because there's a climate set at the top of unbelievable constant lies and hostility and division in this country, not only as policy, but has with his affect.
The conspiracy theories cited by these neo-Nazis in Pittsburgh and New Zealand and now outside San Diego, a conspiracy theory that Trump never condemned and actually seemed to support.
And we don't know if it has any connection to the politics that's going on, but I mean, it would be a stretch to say that it doesn't.
Somebody that's anti-immigrant in California, the anti-immigrant hate and refugee that's going on in the country, what happened at the Tree of Life, and then you couple that with the president's language, it's a big problem.
And remember, Donald Trump just over the last couple of days have been defending what he said in Charlottesville. And it echoed, called back into our memory, right? Something that just happened not too long ago. What happened in Pittsburgh? Donald Trump and all of this hate, right, it's part of the environment of today, and he bears some responsibility for it all.
That's the media, happy to fan the flames. Of course, Joe Biden, he came out with his announcement. He's running for president, and he wants to stir up the hatred that we saw in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. And the media, of course, they twist his words, his comments at that that press gathering from 2017. We're going to play some clips from that at a program later on this week. But there they are, fanning the flames of hatred and division and strife. He's providing the mood music, as you heard there. It's the president's fault. The president is to be blamed for these crazies that are shooting up churches and such. And this, I think it was just a few days ago, where they had that cartoon in the International New York Times with a cartoon of President Trump, and he's being dragged by a dog. Well, this is how Brett Stevens describes it in his column at the New York Times, as it happens. You talk about an uncomfortable column or one that was difficult to write. He works for the New York Times. And he came out and criticized the Times for publishing this anti-Semitic propaganda, this cartoon in the International Edition. It was, I guess, underneath an article from Tom Friedman. But there's this guide dog with a prideful countenance, Brett Stevens writes, and the face of Benjamin Netanyahu leading a blind, fat Donald Trump. Imagine that. Netanyahu's the dog leading this blind U.S. president, the same U.S. president that all these commentators are blaming for shootings in synagogues. He's to blame when a Jew gets shot. And then at the very same, well, in so many of these very same publications, just like you saw in that cartoon, they're saying that it's this president who's just blindly following after the leader of Israel. They want it both ways, you see. The face of Benjamin Netanyahu leading the blind, fat Donald Trump wearing dark glasses, and he's got a kippah on his head. It says, lest there be any doubt as to the identity of the dogman, it wears a collar from which hangs a Star of David. And Brett Stevens goes on to note, what in any other scenario, this just passed, and then finally a few days later it gets some attention because of conservative blogs and such. But what, like Brett Stevens points out, what would the uproar have been? What would it have been like if it was Nancy Pelosi on the leash? Or maybe a black congressman. Or Ilhan Omar. As it was Prime Minister Netanyahu, so, well, what's the big deal? Well, at least Brett Stevens had something to say about it. he's turned into a rabid anti-Trump commentator, but still, as a Jewish columnist, at least he said something. He covers some of the history, too, and it's kind of from the, I guess, the critics of the New York Times perspective. But he says that for some Times readers, or as often former readers, the answer is clear. The answer as to why would the Times publish this? The New York Times, it's owned and operated by a Jewish family. Stephen says, the Times has a long-standing Jewish problem dating back to World War II when it mostly buried news about the Holocaust and continuing into the present day in the form of intensely adversarial coverage of Israel. It says the criticism goes double when it comes to the editorial pages, whose overall approach toward the Jewish state tends to range, with some notable exceptions, from tut-tutting disappointment to thunderous condemnation. That's what they have for Israel. Who really is fanning the flames of hate? When you look at that cartoon or read some of these editorial pages, listen to those commentators. Listen to the way they talk about Donald Trump. Jeremy Corbyn can't even eat in the same room with Trump. But he certainly can with Hamas and Hezbollah and the Chinese leaders. What a world. These are people from our own nations. The division, the sickness from within, it's exactly as Isaiah 1 describes. The sickness, the cancer from within, and it's spreading. Whether it's knife crime, as I read earlier, or just this self-hate. This hatred for our own institutions, for the foundation of our countries. Well, some of that evil is being exposed by this administration. By this, I mean the Trump administration, which is why his enemies hate him so much. I referred to that article, I think it was at the American Thinker last week. The walls are closing in on Obama. He was out there over the weekend, and a lot of his top officials were out there too. They're feeling the prod to defend their administration or to revise the history, as we'll hear from Joe Biden in just a bit. But let me just take you through. First, let's just go through this Kimberly Strassel piece, because the Mueller report is out. It's been out for a couple of weeks now. We went through some of the bits from that on Thursday's show last week. But she writes about the Russians and the dossier. Strassel says, politicians keep reminding us not to lose sight of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's broader assignment to investigate Russia's interference in the 2016 election. If only someone had reminded Mr. Mueller. So everyone's saying, look, the focus here, it was about Russian interference, and that did happen. Okay, so if both sides can agree on that, her point is, if that was the focus of the investigation, then why don't you see more in the report about the dossier? There's just passing references. What was it, 460, 470 pages? Two parts, two volumes? And precious little about the dossier, which is really what got all of this off and running. And they can say it was Papadopoulos and some meetings, some mysterious meetings he had. In fact, it was the dossier. It was the Hillary Clinton fund and dossier. Christopher Steele, Fusion GPS, and all of these Russian agents. One of the biggest failures, it says, of the Mueller probe concerns not what was in the final report, but what was not. Close readers will search in vain for any analysis of the central document in the affair, the infamous dossier. It's a stunning omission, given the possibility that the Russians used that collection of reports to feed disinformation to U.S. intelligence agencies, sparking years of political maelstrom. So if the focus from the beginning was on Russian interference, then why, oh why, wouldn't you go into, in some detail, the origin, the genesis of the Russian dossier or the Steele dossier and all of those lies that got this investigation off and running in the first place? If you want to talk about Russian interference, you have to at least look into that. I mean, if she goes in and summarizes just some of the incredible claims, the bogus claims from the dossier, and we've gone through some of these before in years past, so I won't take the time to just get into all the details. But Paul Manafort, he was right in the middle of this Trump-Russia conspiracy. Carter Page, he was the intermediary, as she says here. Then you had Michael Cohen. Remember, he's supposed to go to Prague to visit with Russians. This is all in the dossier. And all of it untrue. Russians, the dossier says. It had all this compromising information on Donald Trump. He was going to be blackmailed. All of that's in the dossier. It says the Mueller report exposes the dossier claims as pure fiction. Yet, this is Kim Strassel, yet in describing the actions of the Trump campaign figures the FBI accused, the report assiduously avoids any mention of the dossier or its allegations. So it proves that the allegations are not true, but it doesn't then go into the actual allegations from the dossier. He says, she says, Mr. Mueller refers to Mr. Steele and his work largely in passing as part of the report's description of how former FBI Director James Comey informed Mr. Trump of the dossier's existence. It's in there because, as you know some of the history. They had the big investigation hurriedly put together. They had to find out that the Russians, well, they did interfere. And then they had to make this known to President-elect Donald Trump. You know about the meetings on January 5th, 2017, and then January the 6th. And Jim Comey, he had to tell President-elect Trump, look, you should also know about this dossier. It's out there. News media are about to run with it. They're looking for a news hook. And, of course, Comey was creating the news hook, even as he was sitting down with Donald Trump. Kimberly Strassel says, once Mr. Mueller established that the dossier was a pack of lies, he should have investigated how it gained such currency at the highest levels of the FBI. Yet his report makes clear he had no interest. He had no interest in plumbing the antics of the Bureau, which he led from 2001 to 2013. Instead, he went out of his way to avoid the dossier and to give cover to the FBI. This comes back to the whole purpose, really, behind this investigation. 2 years on, or nearly a two-year investigation, it was to give cover to the FBI. Okay, it exposed the dossier, the fraud that document was. But then it didn't go any further. This is real Russian interference we're talking about. It says, in the first telling, Mr. Steele was described by friendly media as simply a former Western intelligence official. Remember all of that early on when we first learned about Christopher Steele? Well, this is a Western intelligence official. This is serious. This is legitimate. He used to work for the MI6. Former Western intelligence official. He had a history at Britain's Overseas Intelligence Service. Kimberly Strassel says, it turns out he worked in Russia. Well, if Carter Page should be spied upon because he made two or three visits to Russia, how about Chris Steele, who lived and worked there? It says, Mr. Steele spent his first years of service under diplomatic cover in Moscow. How about that? Are we serious about looking for Russian interference? It says in 1999, he was among 117 British spies whose covers were publicly blown by a disgruntled ex-MI6 officer. Well, moving on here, she says the former spy, known to the public and therefore to Russia, also became known for sending reports to the U.S. government. Last year, former Obama State Department official Jonathan Weiner explained that in 2009, he became friendly with the self-employed Mr. Steele and started as early as 2013, ensured that more than 100 of Steele's reports on Russia topics were shared with the State Department. Kimberly Strassel says, given that the dossier is largely based on Russian sources, some supposedly connected to the Kremlin, did the Kremlin know about this arrangement and see an opportunity to spoon-feed the U.S. government disinformation? Did the Kremlin know about Steele? Did the Kremlin know that if they fed him bogus information, it would go right to the top level of the U.S. government? Because that's what happened. We now know this. And it seems like Bob Mueller, he's not interested in looking into this at all. They keep reminding us, look, don't lose sight of the fact that special counsel Robert Mueller, he was there to investigate Russia's interference. Well, you talk about interference. Strassel says we've also learned more about Mr. Steele's and Fusion's connections to Russians. She gets into some of those details and then concludes with this. How did Mr. Mueller spend 2 years investigating every aspect of Russian interference, cyber hacking, social media trolling, meetings with Trump officials, and not consider the possibility that the dossier was part of the Russian interference effort? How did this not even get considered? She says that, well, maybe the Justice Department inspector, Michael Horowitz, maybe he'll look into this. Maybe the Attorney General, William Barr, will look into this. But Bob Mueller didn't look into it at all. She says, thanks to the special counsel, we know Republicans weren't playing footsie with Russians. But thanks to BuzzFeed, we know that Democrats were. America deserves to know how far the interaction extended. See, the very ones that are out there crying, Russia, 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 collusion, collusion, collusion. They're the ones colluding with Russia. They're the ones working with foreign agents to bring down the United States of America. It's like my father wrote in the booklet, America under attack. And finally, a fair bit of this nefarious activity, this evil plot, this coup attempt. Finally, some of it's being exposed. As I say, Obama and his people are fighting back. They're out there in full force over the weekend. Well, even at the tail end of last week, I wasn't with you live on Friday's program. But there were comments from John Brennan, Sally Yates, she was on a TV show yesterday. Obama himself, he was at some kind of seminar talking about things he's brought up before, how that he deals in facts. And obviously President Trump does not. President Trump is out there lying. But the Obama people, they know the truth. Sally Yates had an interesting comment. This was with Andrea Mitchell yesterday on one of the cable shows. As she was talking about, well, Mitchell asked her, well, so there's no crimes here and this and this and this. And she said, well, look, I've prosecuted people for far less, based on far less evidence than the Mueller report. Think about that. There's no underlying crime. And then on the second volume of that report, obstruction of justice, William Barr read it and said, there's no obstruction of justice here. And then Sally Yates, this is an Obama person. She was, what was she, the deputy attorney general? And she admitted on TV yesterday, hey, I prosecuted people in using far, far less evidence than the Mueller report. Does that make you feel pretty good about what was going on during the Obama administration? And then with respect to Donald Trump, well, what about this? I mean, Mueller comes out, says there's no crime. What should we do? What should we do with President Trump? This is what Sally Yates said yesterday. Clip three.
But, you know, I think really the bigger issue is not just whether or not this establishes a crime that can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but is this the kind of conduct that we should expect from the President of the United States? I mean, when the Russians came knocking at their door, you would expect that a man who likes to make a show of hugging the flag would have done the patriotic thing and would have notified law enforcement.
So there's no crime. Listen to that. There's no crime there. But the bigger issue is the conduct. It doesn't matter what Mueller turned up or didn't turn up. When the Russians came knocking, he should have sounded the alarm. In other words, he's still a Russian stooge. He's still a Russian agent. And if there's no crime in black and white, well, just look at his overall conduct. That's there for everyone to see. And we all know he's guilty. You listen to Ben Rhodes. He had an interview on Friday. You listen to him talk, and it's as if he's read a completely different report. This was a Ben Rhodes who wasn't quite as calm and collected. He wasn't quite as eloquent as usual because, as I said last week, I think the walls are beginning to close in on some of these Obama people. Let me just play the first clip from Ben Rhodes. This is clip five.
We didn't even know that there was an FBI investigation of Trump. I didn't. President Obama didn't. Like, we actually abided by the firewalls between. If there were any investigations that took place, those decisions were made in the Justice Department, in the FBI, not in the White House. They will find nothing that suggests that there was any political White House involvement in any of that. Literally, I learned about the FBI investigation in Trump as a private citizen in Washington Post. This, you have to understand that we actually abided by the longstanding practice of the White House not getting involved in that kind of stuff.
That's a nervous-sounding Ben Rhodes saying that, well, some of these Republicans are saying this needs to be looked into. How high up did it go? You had the president himself on Sean Hannity's show, I think it was Thursday night last week, saying, if you know Brennan and Clapper and those guys were involved, what's the next level up from there? How far up did this go? Those are the kinds of things that President Trump has been saying, and you can see it's making some of these people nervous. We didn't even know, Ben Rhodes says. I didn't even know till I was a private citizen. And we're supposed to just accept that because they tell the truth. Well, this reporter asked him some pretty pointed questions. I don't have his name offhand, but good for him. In any event, when this next clip, he's talking about, well, what about this investigation into the investigators? What about what some are saying they're going to look into now? Or the Horowitz investigation, or maybe Attorney General Barr, or maybe President Trump releasing some of these documents? What about people being concerned about how this unfolded, how you were spying? And this is Ben Rhodes comparing all of that, the way that this investigation came to light, he's comparing all of that with what he considers to be all this proof of crimes committed by Donald Trump in collusion with the Russians. This is clip six.
I think people can read a report that is exhaustively prepared by a Republican, Bob Mueller, appointed by Republican President George Bush as the director of the FBI, that details exhaustively contacts between President Trump's campaign and associates and a hostile foreign power in order to try to cheat to get elected president of the United States and to repeatedly try to obstruct justice and cover it up. And if that doesn't concern you as an American, if you are somehow okay with people thinking that they should benefit from or potentially help a foreign adversary intervene in our democracy, and if you're so wedded to your own partisan agenda that you're going to engage in kind of stupid, pointless whataboutism that says that somehow the fact that the FBI decided to investigate this is equal to the underlying crimes and unethical and unpatriotic efforts of working with Russia to intervene in our democracy. If you can draw an equivalence, I feel sorry for you if you can draw that equivalence.
That's Ben Rhodes on Friday, 2 weeks after the Mueller report was made public, and he's talking about the underlying crimes, the very thing that the report proved didn't exist. And he says, if you're worried about the FBI investigating into Donald Trump and using these intelligence agencies to spy on Americans, if you're worried about that, I feel sorry for you. Because look at the crimes that have been committed. He says the Trump people were reaching out to a hostile foreign power in order to cheat. That's his narrative. It doesn't matter how long the report is or what the report even says. The narrative in his mind is that Russia meddled in the election and the Trump campaign was in collusion. It was a conspiracy. That's how they won. And then there's all this obstruction of justice to go along with it. Who are you to question the FBI's motives? That's the spirit. That's the attitude coming from the Obama administration, the former administration. No change, no repentance, no, well, hey, at least the Mueller report, I'm relieved. I've read the Mueller report. I'm relieved as an American to know that there was no collusion. Now, on the obstruction thing, there's been some arguing back and forth. I think that still needs to be looked into. That would be a reasonable response. This is someone who read the Mueller report and says, thank you. Donald Trump is guilty. Donald Trump should go to prison. And so they're out there in full force, defending their record, presenting their truth. There's two stories here. And it's all happening in real time. That's what's amazing. Again, I refer you back to Mr. Hilliker's article from The Latest Trumpet. There's no truth in the land. If we can't submit to the will of God, then it's will worship. It's every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. Judges 21:25. Every man just submitting to his own human will or the human will of his party, his group, his champion. Well, some of them on the one side are getting a little bit nervous, as I say, because there's still quite a few documents that haven't even been made public. It's coming out slowly but surely. As I say, President Trump was on Sean Hannity. This next clip, I believe it's from MSNBC, and you'll hear the first part, some of the statements that President Trump made on the Hannity program, and then this reporter on MSNBC allows for John Brennan, he's the former head of the CIA, to answer the charges brought on by President Trump. Clip 4.
I really say now we have to get down, because this was a coup. This was an attempted overthrow of the United States government. These are sick people. These are sick, sick people.
You know,
so let's see what happens with McCabe and Comey and Brennan and Clapper. They weren't in the act. And let's see what happens, and let's see how high it goes up, because it's inconceivable when it goes to Clapper, Brennan, Comey, these people. I would imagine that some other people, maybe a little bit higher up, also knew about it, and maybe a lot higher up.
So that's the president alleging that you, among others, were
in on the act for some kind of an attempted overthrow. How do you respond?
Well, I don't think it's surprising at all that we continue to hear the sociopathic ramblings of Mr. Trump claiming that there was this effort to try to prevent him from being elected or to unseat him. And I welcome any type of, you know, continued investigation in terms of what we did during that period of time that we were in government. And I've testified in front of Congress.
And you would do it again?
Absolutely, I'll do it again. And so people have called for me to do it, and Rand Paul and others, they make these very specious allegations that have no basis in truth, but they put it into the bloodstream, and then unfortunately certain networks will propagate that.
That last statement is especially rich. Specious allegations that have no basis in truth. Think about the Steele dossier. Specious allegations that have no basis in truth, but they put it into the bloodstream, and then, unfortunately, certain networks will propagate that. The Steele dossier, BuzzFeed, CNN. 2 years. 2 years of this. That's how John Brennan responds. You heard Ben Rhodes for his part. And then Joe Biden, of course, he was there as President Obama's vice president for 8 years. He was on The View Friday talking about how perfect that administration was. The one thing that stands out to him during his 8 years as vice president was this, clip 7.
Not one single whisper of scandal.
Not one.
Not one single whisper of scandal.
That's Barack Obama.
That's right. It's because of Barack.
Not one scandal. 8 years of perfection. An angelic reign from 2009 to 2016. The Washington Examiner drawing attention to that statement by former Vice President Biden. This author refers to the Obama people out there trying to rewrite the pre-Donald Trump history to try to erase all of the corruption, all of the scandals. It says here, during that administration, this is the Washington Examiner, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives spearheaded a disastrous gun-walking operation in which it lost track of 1,300 firearms from a total of 2,000 that it allowed to be purchased illegally and circulated into Mexico. One of the firearms was used later in the murder of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. This all happened during Obama's watch. It says, in the ensuing congressional investigation, America's top law enforcement officer, Eric Holder, who actually described himself as the president's wingman, was held in contempt by lawmakers, making him the first attorney general in U.S. history to hold that distinction. The first ever attorney general held in contempt by Congress. Listen to this. It says, during the Obama era, at least 7 American citizens were killed by drone strikes. Of those 7, only 1 was targeted intentionally by the U.S. government. He was executed without any form of due process. Of the remaining 6 that the Obama White House claimed it killed accidentally, 1 was a 16-year-old boy, the son of American-born Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. It says the teen was eating dinner with his father, the real target of the attack, when they were killed by a drone strike. Like the others who were not targeted intentionally by the U.S. government, the Obama administration coolly wrote off the American teen's demise as collateral damage. Asked to justify the boy's death, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs responded by saying, "I would suggest that you should have a far more responsible father if they are truly concerned about the well-being of their children." In total, the Obama administration authorized 542 drone strikes, resulting in the deaths of an estimated 3,797 people, including 324 civilians, according to the Council on Foreign Relations, and all this from a Nobel Peace Prize winner, who once joked in 2011, turns out I'm really good at killing people. Didn't know that was going to be a strong suit of mine. Well, the article goes on. The IRS scandal, the Veteran Affairs scandal. Obama's Secretary of Veteran Affairs resigned in disgrace after it was revealed and an estimated 307,000 veterans died awaiting medical attention. Obama's Office of Personnel Management was hacked. His Secretary of State maintained a homebrew server in her bathroom so as to avoid record-keeping laws and procedures. And the Justice Department spied on journalists. I could go on and on, but I have a word count to maintain, says the author. I could go on and on. You've got the IRS using government agencies, weaponizing agencies to go after political opponents. And all of this led right into spying on Americans, spying on political opponents, attempting to take down the presidency. Continues right to this day. And yet you have Mr. Biden out there laughably carrying on with this falsehood that somehow or another that administration for eight years going completely scandal-free. It says here it would be enough for Biden and others to allege the Obama administration was not as corrupt as the Trump administration. That can be argued. It says, but he's greedy in his claims. Obama alumni are not content merely to compare themselves favorably to the current administration. They want also to compare themselves to angels. They are no angels, as the number of dead Americans and foreign civilians can attest. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a short study. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Last Thursday, I didn't have enough time to get into Exodus 13 and 14. I encouraged you to read it on your own, if you could. But I'll just draw attention to Exodus 14 in particular, where Moses is interacting with God and praying for God to deliver the Israelites. They were surrounded by mountains and the Red Sea and, of course, Pharaoh's army. And at one point in the exchange, God says to Moses, look, why are you crying out to me? Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward. Tell the people of God to move forward. And as they went forward, God performed a mighty miracle. The two go hand in hand. God intervening miraculously and us, the people of God, walking forward in faith, knowing that God's about to perform a miracle. We can't sit back and wait for the miracle. We move forward in faith. That's one of the great lessons of the spring holy days. Moving forward in faith. Notice Hebrews 12, verse 1. It says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us." Lay aside those weights that slow you down, that burden us down, and run. Run forward. Think of the example of David when he ran out to meet Goliath. Well, before that even, they had burdened him down. Saul's people burdened him down with all of this heavy armor. And he removed it, David did. He wasn't used to it. It wasn't tested. So he took off that heavy weight and then ran out to meet Goliath. Verse 2, here in Hebrews, it says, "Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." Lay aside those weights. Run with patience. Run in this race. And look to Jesus Christ. He's out front. He's out front fighting for us. He's out front parting the waters of the Red Sea. Notice a passage in the book of Habakkuk, switching over to the Old Testament. God, throughout the Bible, there's quite a few references to the feet of the righteous. And God really praises the feet of the righteous because of their movement, their running. Verse 2 of Habakkuk 2, it says, "And the Eternal answered me and said, Write the vision and make it plain upon the tables, that they may run that read it." Make this clear. Write down this revelation. Record it in a book so that when people read it later, they can really run with it. The Habakkuk booklet, it says, God commands us to make the vision plain, and we are. People can now read it and run. They can become urgent in this last hour. And then my father says this, it's a time not to walk, but to run spiritually. If ever there was a time to run, it is now. We've got to move forward. Now is the time to run, he says in that booklet. This is why God repeatedly emphasizes our feet, spiritually speaking. He wants us to run with the message. It says, "For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry." God says it's coming. There is an appointed time. Just keep running. Keep running. We can't afford to slow down. Not now, not ever. We don't want to pull back. We want to go forward. We want to go forward in faith. Now is the time to run in this race. Notice Isaiah 52. We can finish off over here. Isaiah 52. Well, you put what we read there in Habakkuk, put it together again with this message. Running with this message, it's in our hearts, it's in our minds, and we declare it. We excitedly declare this truth to as many as will listen to it in the hope that they will take it and run with it themselves. Isaiah 52 and verse 1, it says, "Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion, put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall no more come into you the uncircumcised and the unclean. Put on all these righteous garments. Shake yourself from the dust. Arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the bands of your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. Let go of those bands. Lay aside those weights, anything that will slow you down. Set them aside." And then down in verse 7, it says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings, that publishes peace, that brings good tidings of good that publishes salvation, that says unto Zion, your God reigns. How beautiful are the feet of a messenger from God, bringing good tidings, bringing good news to this world, just like Herbert Armstrong did, just like my father brings on the Key of David. In Isaiah's end time vision, it says, anciently a messenger had to get on his feet to deliver the message. He often ran. The good messenger didn't talk about delivering the message. He just used his feet to get the job done. When he delivered God's message, it was received by God's people with great joy. They knew he had beautiful feet because of the message those feet were used to deliver. And then my father says, and so it is today. God talks about beautiful feet for a very good reason. He wants his messengers today to deliver his message. He says, finally, many people talk about doing God's work, but very few simply get busy and do the job. God wants you, he wants me, he wants all of us to get busy and do the job. A little less talk and a lot more action, as the saying goes. A lot of people can talk about doing God's work, but how many are out there actually getting busy and doing the job? My father says only a few know God's message must be delivered by using their beautiful feet. That's from Isaiah's end time vision. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.